History isn't just a bunch of names and dates and facts. It's the collection of all the stories throughout human history that explain how and why we got here. Welcome to the History Unplugged podcast, where we look at the forgotten, neglected, strange, and even counterfactual stories that made our world what it is. I'm your host, Scott Rank. One of the most powerful bodies in the American federal government is the Presidential Cabinet. This is a private advisory board for the president. But what's interesting is that the U.S. Constitution never established a presidential cabinet. In fact, the delegates to the Constitutional Convention rejected the idea. And in fact, for the first 2.5 years of George Washington's first administration, he didn't have a cabinet. So why did he create one? How did it become one of the most powerful bodies in the federal government? And why is it something that can just about determine whether a presidency fails or succeeds? Consider the Doris Kearns Goodwin book, Team of Rivals, where she argues that the way that Abraham Lincoln set up his cabinet was what allowed him to win the Civil War. I'm looking into this topic today with Lindsay Travinsky, who's the author of the new book, The Cabinet, George Washington and the Creation of an American Institution. The story starts in 1791 when George Washington convened his department secretaries, Alexander Hamilton, Thomas Jefferson, Henry Knox, and Edmund Randolph, for the first cabinet meeting. The U.S. Constitution didn't create or provide for such a body, so Washington was on his own. This group of advisors was based on the councils of war that Washington held as commander of the Continental Army, and it helped him overcome diplomatic crises, domestic insurrections like the Whiskey Rebellion in 1794, and constitutional conventions. And he did this because he thought that congressional help was lacking. So in this discussion, we look at what his cabinet was like and how far apart politically were Thomas Jefferson and Alexander Hamilton and others, whether they were as close as a modern-day Rockefeller Republican and Rust Belt Democrat would be, or they were as far apart from each other as, say, Alexandra Ocasio-Cortez and Steve King would be, completely opposite sides on left and right. We also discuss how cabinets could make a presidency succeed or fail, what makes a good cabinet. And finally, I ask Lindsay, if she were president, how would she select her cabinet? Would she just survey the land of the United States and choose the most competent people? Or would she look for loyalty above all else so that the cabinet members don't try to leak things to the press and subtly and sneakily try to destroy her presidency as some cabinet members did in the past? So this is a really good look at the inside of American power politics. And I hope you enjoyed this discussion with Lindsay Travinsky. Lindsay, welcome to the show.
Thanks so much for having me. I'm thrilled to be here.
Absolutely. I love looking into the understanding the relevance of people that shaped America and in our past. And before we get too far into Washington and the development of a presidential cabinet, I want to look at something that you wrote about recently, where you talked about how the founding fathers in Washington, you believe, would have responded to COVID-19, because of course, this isn't the first pandemic that the United States has faced. These go throughout history. And we have examples in the past to understand how they would have responded. So how do you think Washington would have, in light of the challenges of his time of federalism versus centralized power and all that?
It's a great question, and it's a tricky one to answer because, as you mentioned, there were pandemics at that time. The 1793 yellow fever outbreak in Philadelphia, for example, was right smack dab in the middle of Washington's presidency. And at that point, the consensus, by and large, was that public health, if they even had sort of a concept of that, was very much a local issue. So there was a lot of debate over what sort of immigrants to let into the nation, what sort of local projects to do to try and make cities more healthful. But it really wasn't a national concept. That being said, the founders definitely understood that there was a need for federal power when national crises came up, and that certain issues really required a coordinated, unified response and could not be done piecemeal state by state. So diplomacy is a great example. You can't have 13 states negotiating 13 different policies. And economic policy often requires more unity as well, because you don't want states trying to undercut each other. And that we have certainly seen the federal government has expanded in that way. I think the key difference between 1793 and today is that the yellow fever outbreak was really localized because it really depended on mosquito populations. Whereas, of course, the crisis we're dealing with today is a national one, and we've seen states try and come together to form blocks to sort of work in coordinated action. But I do think that they, you know, if they were alive today, in addition to being like, why are there planes in the sky? I think that they would certainly call for unified federal action.
So I'm curious about the beginning of a presidential cabinet, because I'm not a historian of presidents or American politics. I am only a historian of that in as much as it has to do with the Ottoman Empire. But I was surprised to learn from your book that for the first 2.5 years of Washington's presidency, he didn't have a cabinet. So when constitutional conventions are happening and the founding fathers are architecting what the American government will look like, what was it like at the beginning of Washington's presidency when he didn't have a cabinet? Was he largely working solo or with legislators or something else?
Yeah, so the Constitution actually doesn't have the word cabinet in it. And the delegates to the Constitutional Convention explicitly rejected proposals that looked quite similar to how the cabinet eventually developed. So they really didn't want this sort of advisory body forming. And as the president of the Constitutional Convention, Washington attended every session. He drank tea and went to the theater and socialized with the delegates after each workday. So he had a very good understanding of their expectations of what he would do once he was in office. And they expected the president to do two things. First, they expected the president to request written advice from the department secretaries. And that was really important because if it was written, then there was a trail of evidence about who said what and who advocated which position. And it would really force people to take responsibility and have transparency at the highest levels of government. They didn't want people meeting secretly in a room and there being no record of who said what. And the second option that they laid out was that the president would advise and consent with the Senate on foreign affairs and appointments. And this is really different than what we see, obviously, in the 21st century, where the Senate is either sort of a rubber stamp or a veto on treaties and appointments. At that point, they really expected the Senate to serve as a council of advice and to provide that sort of feedback and support. So when Washington entered into his office, he really tried to use those two options. He visited with the Senate to try and get their input on a diplomatic issue. And that meeting didn't go very well because the Senate was acting like a legislative body and wanted to refer the issue to committee to discuss it more. And they wanted Washington to come back at another date. And he wanted, you know, immediate, efficient responses that would actually allow him to take action. So that option didn't go very well. And he never went back to the Senate for advice. And he also requested written advice from the department secretaries. But the issues that were facing him and the secretaries were so complex and so difficult because they're trying to build a government from scratch and, you know, basically lead a nation. They found it infuriating to try and write these letters back and forth with parchment and quill, because what happens if you have follow-up questions or what happens if something isn't clear? So Washington started sending letters. They would, you know, exchange a letter or two, and then he would ask the secretaries to come for individual meetings. And that way they could sort of hammer out all of the details and it would be a little bit faster. So that was really what he did for the first 2.5 years. And he sort of explored some other options. He worked closely with Madison in the first year of the administration to sort of smooth things over between the presidency and the House of Representatives. So in some way, Madison was almost kind of like an unofficial prime minister. But as their relationship soured, that kind of went by the wayside. But it wasn't until 2.5 years into Washington's presidency that he actually convened the first cabinet meeting.
That's very interesting, because the way that American history is taught, at least in public schools, is that during the period with the Articles of Confederation, there was chaos because the states couldn't coordinate their affairs the way that a nation state should. But after the Second Constitutional Convention, then a functional government emerges with a stronger central government and America goes on its merry way. But it doesn't quite sound like this the first 2 years. Do you think that was the vision of a president and his powers much more circumscribed at the beginning than it would later become, you think, or is that not quite accurate?
Well, I certainly think that they were trying to create a strong, efficient president. Now, it's obviously expanded much more than I think they would have anticipated, especially in moments like the Civil War and World War II, and then sort of the post-war imperial presidency. But I think the key is actually for people, I would encourage everyone to look at the Constitution and look at Article 2 especially, which is the part that pertains to the presidency. And it's incredibly short. there aren't that many details about like what the day-to-day governing is supposed to be and how the president is supposed to sort of handle affairs that, you know, come across his desk every day. And so Washington really had to sort of figure out and fill out the fuzzy details that weren't actually written down. And so much of the presidency and the executive branch and our government more generally is really built on custom as opposed to law that has been passed. And so it's these customs that Washington was building, and he really had sort of the leeway to carve out additional authority that maybe wasn't anticipated. So a great example is in 1794 when there's the Whiskey Rebellion, and we can talk about that a little bit more later if you'd like, but Washington saw it as an opportunity to carve out more authority for the president over domestic issues, which really was sort of supposed to be a congressional sort of area of jurisdiction. So he had a vision of what a strong government should be. The cabinet secretaries really supported that vision, and that really paved the way for the strong president that we know eventually happened.
Yeah, that's interesting that the way people approach the Constitution or the American system of government is very similar to religions, where some, like a Puritan, think that we need to go back to the earliest period and the source and remove all accoutrements and other things. And the purity is the Articles of Confederation, or a period without a cabinet, a period without political parties, this golden age, this Garden of Eden. Whereas others would say, well, religion is a constant revelation, and as we learn new things, we incorporate it. And the government view is, well, as we fill things out, as we add new systems, we can do government more efficiently. So I'm sure that analogy has been made. I really doubt I'm the first guy to think that up, but...
No, but it's a great analogy. And I think that it's, you know, it's true because Washington went into office with this sort of set of expectations. But then when the rubber hits the road, you can't necessarily stick to what is written down if that's not actually going to work in the day-to-day operation. And so pretty much immediately he starts dismissing things that are actually written down in the Constitution because they don't actually function day-to-day. And so, you know, whenever anyone asks me about original intent, I always point to Washington's actions because from the very beginning, he is experimenting and trying to figure out what will actually help him be a good leader. And, you know, I think that the delegates at the Constitutional Convention expected that. They knew they didn't have all the answers. They knew that they necessarily come up with a perfect solution. And they hoped that future generations would be able to improve on the experiment and come up with better solutions to big problems.
What triggered Washington calling his department secretaries for the first cabinet meeting? And who were these people at the first cabinet meeting?
So Washington's first cabinet was the Secretary of State, Thomas Jefferson, Secretary of Treasury, Alexander Hamilton, Attorney General Edmund Randolph, and Secretary of War, Henry Knox. So probably some names that people are familiar with, and maybe some not so much. What caused Washington to actually convene the first meeting was that Jefferson had received word from the British minister that a treaty that they were sort of discussing had been tabled by the Privy Council, and they were no longer considering it. And it was a very disrespectful decision because it basically treated the United States as sort of a non-entity or like a pawn that they could just move around and deal with when they saw fit. And so Jefferson was really frustrated. Washington was really frustrated. And they convened this cabinet meeting to sort of discuss the state of diplomacy with all of the major European powers and what was the state of sort of their economic relationship and their diplomatic relationship and what sort of treaties would they hope to accomplish and sign in the next several years. Now, what's really interesting about this cabinet meeting is not actually that much comes out of it. The plans that they sort of put forth don't ever really come to fruition, or at least not for many, many years. But it's fascinating because the issues they discuss sort of serve as a roadmap for what's going to really capture the cabinet's attention over the next several years.
Well, I'd love to know more about these particular members of his cabinet, and specifically in light of how far apart were they on the political map? I mean, if we're thinking about a modern day equivalent, would they be, you know, some center left people and some center right people, like a Rockefeller Republican and a Rust Belt Democrat type of thing? Or would it be as extreme as Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez and Steve King of Iowa, the sort of the two complete opposites of the spectrum coming together? Where were they on the map?
That's a great question. And actually one that no one has really asked me before. So in some ways they were really quite close. So for example, in 1793, when international war broke out, Jefferson and Hamilton, for all of their disagreements, they both agreed that the United States had to remain Now, Hamilton wanted sort of a pro-British neutrality, and Jefferson wanted a French, because depending on how you enforced it, it kind of favored each side a little bit differently. But they didn't, neither of them wanted to go to war. And so in that sense, their difference is really quite narrow. But then on other issues, like their vision for what the country should become, they were really quite far apart. And so I think it would be much more akin to having sort of a more progressive Democrat and a more conservative Republican in the same cabinet. So Jefferson really thought that the country should be made up of yeoman farmers, which is basically each man should have his own farm that could support his family and allow him to be independent and not in debt to anyone. He thought that cities were sort of dangerous and breeding grounds for sin and corruption and disease. And so he didn't really want anything to do with them. And while he understood that trade was important to be able to sell the farmers' goods, he didn't want the government prioritizing that or investing in promoting that. Now, on the other hand, Hamilton really thought that industry and cities and urban centers and merchants and trade were the future. And that was really how the country should look. And the government should be big and powerful and strong and should promote these industries. And so in some ways, you know, Hamilton's sort of vision for the country certainly won out. It's definitely how much more akin to how our country looks today. But in other ways, you know, the sort of Jeffersonian ideal of what a citizen should be. And, you know, even like sort of the 1950s version of that is the white picket fence and, you know, everyone having a suburban home. It still sort of lingers with us today.
Hey, everyone. Scott here. We're going to take a very short break for a word from our sponsors. In your book, you describe a cabinet as something that became one of the most powerful bodies in the federal government. With these four meeting together, how does it start out? Is it immediately become a body imbued with a lot of power, or is it something that becomes that over time?
It's definitely been a transition. So, I mean, the cabinet is obviously much larger. It's much more institutionalized today than it was back then. Washington and the secretaries really drew a distinction between sort of their day-to-day interactions and then when they met as a group. So when Washington met with the secretaries as individuals, they were really usually talking about sort of the bureaucratic issues within their own department and any issues that came up in that way. When they came together, they were providing advice and support on issues that were so big that they sort of defied fitting into one department. So war or rebellion that had ramifications for the War Department and the State Department and the Treasury Department. And so when they first gathered together, it was really a very private advisory body, and it was really designed to give the best advice possible to Washington. And the secretaries understood that the meetings were not intended to convey more power to them. Instead, they meant to help sort of boost or promote the presidency. And so in some ways, the cabinet certainly has expanded and taken on more bureaucratic authority. But I would argue that there's sort of a key element, which is that the secretaries are still not permitted or, you know, they don't have a right to be a part of the decision-making process. They are invited by the president to provide their suggestions and their opinions, but he is not obligated to take them, and he's not even really obligated to listen to what they have to say.
Right, and you note that the model of the cabinet was similar to the councils of war that he led as commander of the Continental Army. One person in his cabinet, Henry Knox. First of all, I'd love to hear more about Henry Knox and Edmund Randolph. And second, this type of council of war, does it seem like the people who are in the cabinet have a personal connection to Washington the way a council of war would?
Yes, absolutely. So when Washington was deciding who to appoint as his secretaries, he had a couple of important considerations. The first was that he needed to have a personal relationship with them, so he knew all of the secretaries before appointing them to office. And they had varying degrees of closeness, but he knew all of them, and he trusted them, which was really important. The second was that they had to have expertise or knowledge or experience that was different from his own, so that he could learn from them and they could contribute information, because Washington was very aware of his own limitations. And the third was that they needed to represent sort of different regions of the country or different factional interests. And that is a precedent that has continued today. Most presidents appoint a cabinet that is quite diverse. And of course, our definition of diversity has expanded, but it's a great way to build coalitions and support for your administration. But I'm really glad you asked about Randolph and Knox, because they tend to be very overshadowed by the boisterous personalities of Hamilton and Jefferson. So Henry Knox was originally a bookseller in Boston, Massachusetts. He was self-trained. Everything he learned about the military came from books. He was one of the first officers that Washington was really close to in the Revolution. And he sort of built his fame for his famous trip to Fort Ticonderoga to bring back recently captured cannons that served a really key role in the siege of Boston. And he eventually became the Major General of Artillery. He was an essential part of Washington's military family and their military success. He then went on to serve as the Secretary of War under the Confederation Congress and Washington's Secretary of War as well. And so not only did he have this very important military experience, but in his capacity as Secretary of War, he had overseen many of the negotiations and treaties with Native American nations. And so he was able to provide that insight, which was ended up being a really huge issue for the first couple of years of the Washington presidency, trying to figure out how to have peaceful relationships with these other nations. So that was one really important person. Edmund Randolph is the other, and he was an aide-de-camp to Washington early in the war before Hamilton signed on as one of Washington's aides. He then went back to Virginia, and he served as the Attorney General of the state. He served as the governor of the state, and he was also Washington's private lawyer for that entire time. So they had known each other for decades and were very close, or I think as close as Washington really got to other men. But he was also a brilliant legal mind. And even though Hamilton and Jefferson had their own legal training, they would often consult with Randolph on a legal question or a constitutional question because they respected what he had to say so much. So he was a very important part of the cabinet. And after Jefferson retired, he became the second Secretary of State and was really at that point Washington's closest advisor.
All of that makes sense, except Thomas Jefferson. I know later he and Washington had severe differences of opinion. Jefferson used anonymous handles to insult Washington in the press. Washington, of course, found out because you're not going to get something around a former spy master. That's just a lesson there. But at this time, did they have a better working relationship, Jefferson and Washington?
Yeah, they did. I mean, initially, I think they had a really good working relationship. They did have respect for one another. And despite Jefferson's sort of opinions that have, you know, lived on in paper because he had such a voluminous correspondence and he lived so long, Washington actually continued to value what Jefferson had to say until he retired. And Washington didn't always side with Hamilton. He often would go back and forth or try and find a middle ground. And so getting that perspective from Jefferson, Washington recognized that it was different than the perspective that Hamilton offered. And he felt that that was really, really helpful. And so they did have a good working relationship. And even when Jefferson didn't always agree with Washington's policies, he was very careful to always sort of support them publicly. And I mean, of course, anonymously, he was doing a lot of other things on the side, but supporting them publicly and not trying to reduce executive power in his capacity as Secretary of State, which I think is something that most people don't realize.
I'd like to take a step out and ask a more timeless question about cabinets. It sounds like there are differing opinions here in Washington's cabinet, which he valued. And that sounds like the Doris Kearns Goodwin book, Team of Rivals, about Lincoln's cabinet, which Lincoln took a group of rivals. And Goodwin argues that this is what helped him through the Civil War to have a diverse body and not just a bunch of yes men. Famously, Barack Obama read this book and it influenced him in his first term to try to have a similar diversity. Now, we're academic historians. We love to slice and dice and pull apart other people's books. That's what we do. You know, it's all to make the craft better. So Doris Kearns Goodwin, do you agree with that? I mean, is that always the optimal situation, a so-called team of rivals? Is it good in some situations, not good in others? Do you completely disagree with her thesis altogether? What do you think?
Oh, that's a great question. For starters, I would say that Lincoln certainly very successfully managed the team of rivals. And Doris Kearns Goodwin did an amazing job sharing that story. Where I think that I disagree a little bit is that that was kind of standard practice up until the time. Most presidents selected people from their own party that would become sort of the heirs apparent. And that often led to a lot of conflict. So, for example, James Monroe's cabinet was often, you know, just absolutely fractured by conflict because John Quincy Adams and Calhoun really both wanted to be the next president. So they were constantly squabbling over who was sort of going to be the next in line. I think that the team of rivals concept can be a very effective one if the president knows how to manage it. So, for example, FDR was great at this. He also appointed people across the political spectrum. He had several Republicans in his cabinet, especially during the war years, to make sure there was a unified war effort. But he was brilliant at managing those sort of different personalities. And so I think that it really comes down to each president's ability to manage the people around them, because usually they're not going to be wallflowers. They're going to have, you know, big egos and ambitions and ideas. They're going to be used to being heard and listened to. And so that can be an almost impossible task. And the way the cabinet is has been set up and was set up by Washington, it is sometimes an impossible task to keep all of those people together. So for Washington, it was very helpful to hear all of these different perspectives. And he was kind of able to hold the administration together until Jefferson decided he couldn't really handle that sort of conflict anymore. And there have been some great examples of presidents who have done a really good job of bringing together these people. But there have also been a number of presidents who have really struggled with that if they take a more hands-off approach, like John Adams or James Madison or, Kennedy had sort of two cabinets going, and that can present a whole other host of problems. So I think that the cabinet is a great way to actually evaluate presidential leadership, because it shows how presidents, what their capabilities are in terms of managing people and getting the people around them to sort of work towards a common goal.
And I like to come back to that of doing a survey of presidents who handled it well and poorly, because in my case of looking at the Ottoman Empire, you had sultans with a group of advisors, but some sultans who were so weak that they made James Buchanan mm-hmm. look like Teddy Roosevelt. And so what happens with people like this, at best they have yes men who tell the sultan whatever they want to hear, because the sultan is at least competent enough to execute people who are a power threat. At worst, they don't even understand what's coming, and then this sultan is deposed and executed and replaced by the advisor's right-hand man. So it's a factor in lots of different types of governmental systems. But I'd like to come to something you mentioned earlier, which I think is a good case study of how this new system of having a cabinet will go after particular crises. So the Whiskey Rebellion, how is it handled by Washington and his cabinet?
You're right. The Whiskey Rebellion is a great case study. I think it's one of my favorites because it shows really the breadth of cabinet possibilities and how effective they can be if they work together or if the president manages them well. So what happened in 1794 is that there was a rebellion in western Pennsylvania. There had been tensions simmering for a very long time over a whiskey tax, and it eventually broke out into violence in July when local rebels burned down the house of a tax collector. And so Washington gathered the cabinet and tried to figure out what they were going to do. And this meeting is fascinating as a historian, and I think I would argue as an American as well, because they could have done a number of different things, including convene Congress for an emergency session to try and get Congress to call up the army and deal with this issue, which is sort of maybe what we would think of most with a domestic problem. They could have waited until Congress came back into session in the fall around late October, early November. Or they could have left the issue to the states to handle because this was a rebellion in Pennsylvania. But instead, Washington and the secretaries decide that an immediate action is necessary, and they decide not to involve Congress. So within, I think what I'm based on the evidence, it seems like within just a couple of minutes, they have sidelined Congress altogether. And then they're trying to figure out, okay, well, what are we going to do? And Hamilton and Knox support sort of immediate military action. And Edmund Randolph says, you know, I'm fine calling up the militia, but let's try a peaceful solution first. And William Bradford, who is the new attorney general, actually comes up with sort of an in-between, which is send out a peace commission, show that you are trying every peaceful solution possible. But while that's happening, let's get the militia ready so that if we do need to go towards a military response, we can do so right away. And that really spoke to Washington's sensibilities because he didn't want to get too far out in front of public opinion. He cared very much about sort of cultivating good favor from citizens. And so he didn't want to be seen to be riding out, you know, ahead of the army, arresting his citizens if he didn't have to. So that was the solution they decided to go with. And then they met with the Pennsylvania officials to sort of tell them they were doing this. And the Pennsylvania officials were shocked and horrified because they felt like this was an egregious abuse of power that was not lined out in the Constitution and that it was really a state issue and they should handle it. And so over the next several weeks, basically the cabinet works to browbeat the Pennsylvania officials into submission and to bullying them into comply with Washington's decision and Washington's orders. And there's a series of absolutely extraordinary letters that Hamilton drafts and then Randolph sort of revises a little bit and then sends to the governor of Pennsylvania. And they're just amazing documents that sort of show the full personalities on display. But eventually, the Pennsylvania officials led by Governor Thomas Mifflin decide to comply. And Washington calls up the troops and the militia marches up to Western Pennsylvania and the rebellion collapses basically immediately. And so Washington is able to eventually grant a lot of clemency and leniency towards these rebels. But what's really interesting is that when Congress comes back into session later in the fall, they don't rebuke Washington. They don't say that he acted inappropriately. And so as a result, there is this precedent for presidents acting quickly and decisively and coming up with strategies to handle domestic issues like rebellions or things, you know, maybe a little bit less serious. And so the cabinet works with Washington to carve out this sphere of influence over domestic policy, not because it will give them more power, but because it will boost presidential authority.
Hey everyone, Scott here. One more brief word from our sponsors. It sounds like with Washington that a cabinet, this private advisory body that's summoned as needed, it works well. Whatever the literalist interpretation of the Constitution is, a cabinet is more effective at the governing realities of the United States. And you mentioned earlier that for certain presidents, a cabinet is an excellent asset, but for other presidents, it can undermine their administration and goals. So could you give examples of each?
Yeah, absolutely. So the cabinet, when it's working really well and when it's functioning as it should, it tends to blend into the background and we don't really pay attention to it all that much because its successes appear to be presidential successes. And we don't really hear about, you know, any sort of conflict. When cabinets start to have divisions or scandals or they really screw up, then they become much more visible. And that really can undermine the president's authority to speak on behalf of the nation internationally, to get things done, to pass legislation, you name it. So a couple of examples of cabinets that worked really well. Jefferson actually had the most sturdy cabinet in American history. So he had the least amount of turnover. And I make sure I distinguish between like what cabinet worked well in terms of trying to pursue their policies, not whether I necessarily think those policies were good policies. So they were a very effective tool for public outreach, for a congressional liaison to try and get things done. Now, the embargo of 1807 ended up kind of being a total failure, but they were really good at implementing it and getting it passed and, you know, initially rallying support behind it. So that's an example of one that worked really well. Of course, is an example of one that worked really well. FDR is a great example of someone who managed his cabinet very smoothly and despite being in office for a very long time, actually had shockingly little turnover, especially in the big positions like Department of State. I would say that Obama's cabinet was a really successful cabinet. He had very little turnover. He had very little cabinet scandal. And so that permits him to be a much more successful president to pursue policies and to reach out to the American public. Now, the ones that are not so good, those are in some ways even more fun. So John Adams was absolutely terrible because he expected that his secretaries that he held over from Washington's administration would be loyal to him and loyal to the office of the presidency. And instead, they were really loyal to Hamilton. And so he suffered from sort of a lack of cabinet management. Same thing with James Madison. He took a really hands-off approach, and that was really terrible. Jackson really struggled with his cabinet because it fractured very early on over a conflict over one of the secretary's wives. And so he basically had to fire the entire cabinet, and then he fired a whole other set of secretaries as well because he wanted to surround himself with yes men. And so he had to go through several rounds of cabinet secretaries to find those yes men who were willing to implement the policies that he wanted. I would suggest that Kennedy's cabinet wasn't a great one because when you have two different cabinet institutions, the more secret one like the kitchen cabinet and a more public one like the real cabinet, there's a lot of confusion internally and publicly about who's actually calling the shots and who people should listen to and what are the voices that need to be held responsible. So those are some examples of ones that maybe haven't gone quite so well.
Well, thanks for walking us through this. And to close things out, I'd like to get into the process of choosing a cabinet because you've spent hundreds, if not thousands of hours contemplating this. So you have as expert of an opinion as anyone could have. And that is how you would choose your own cabinet. And the hypothetical scenario is you've left the academic historical world, you've entered politics, you've had extraordinary success, state senator, then governor, and it's 2032. You are elected president. You're the second president of the United States, and I won't say who the first was in this alternate future, whatever. second female president of the United States. And you have to choose your cabinet. Now, from what you can tell, what's the best? Is it I'm surveying the entire landscape of the United States and this person, that person is the most competent in this or that area, so I choose them, or I have a personal relationship and we trust each other. I know they're not going to backstab me and leak to the press the way this person would, or a mixture of the two. Based on from what you've seen of the people who chose good cabinets and functioning cabinets and made the policies happen, how do you go about choosing these people?
Oh, it's a great question. So I think you have to have some blend of the two. You can't have only friends and cronies because you're likely to not hear the diversity of voices you actually need. And it's really helpful to have different experiences represented in the cabinet because sometimes you need multiple different perspectives to come up with a creative solution. And our country is very big. It is very diverse. There is not, you know, one person that can understand every single path that Americans walk down. So I think that diversity in this case is critical because it allows you to understand, you know, some of the different places that people are coming from. And when I say diversity, I mean racial diversity, gender diversity, religion diversity, but also in terms of experience. I don't have a military background, so I obviously need advisors that do have that sort of experience, or I'm not going to understand what they're talking about. Similarly, if I've come from sort of an academic and government world, I haven't really been in business. So it's really important to have people who have success in that field. So it's not just about what you look like. It's also about what you know, where you've been, maybe where you're from, different parts of the country. But then you also do have to have some level of trust. So I think where sometimes people get into trouble is they think, okay, you have to have the entire country. I'm going to go a bipartisan, like completely across the field. And that only really works if the people are willing to work with you. So in the case of FDR, when he selected a couple of Republicans, they didn't necessarily agree on domestic policy, but they agreed on how to best move forward the war effort. So that made a lot of sense. And same with Obama, he kept on Robert Gates, who agreed on the same military strategy, even if they didn't necessarily see eye to eye on all social policy. So it's really important to pick people you can actually work with and you can sort of find a common ground. And so, you know, if I were to put together a cabinet, I would certainly look for people who maybe were on a different side of the political line than I am, but not so far that we wouldn't ever be able to agree on anything.
All right. Well, that's a great approach. And your book is The Cabinet, George Washington and the Creation of an American Institution. I think it's a great book for people who want to understand the inner workings of governmental power and how it's actually used and not just the simple three branches of government. So this was really great, Lindsay. I really appreciate you coming on and sharing all this with us.
Oh, my pleasure. Thank you so much for having me. This was a really fun conversation.
All right, listeners. Well, that is all that I have for today's episode. Once again, I want to start things off by thanking the Spymasters of History Unplugged. I'll explain what that is in a second. Our Spymasters include Bill Ivey, Moondoggy from Ohio, Tom from Ohio, Ryan Gillen, Rob from Chicago, Nick Brooks, Michael from New York, Carl from Norway, Josh Reddick, Jennifer French-Lee, Jay Carrington, The McCrays, David Santee, Chris C., and Baron Fraser. If you'd like to support the show, there's some very easy ways to do so. First, go to the site halfpricehistory.com. I've worked out an arrangement with a lot of the authors who've appeared on this show, and you can go there and get their books for 50% off. All you have to do is go to halfpricehistory.com and enter the promo code UNPLUGGED at checkout. Second, please leave a review and subscribe to this podcast on your favorite podcast player of choice, whether Apple Podcasts or Spotify or Stitcher or whatever. Third, join our Facebook group. You can go to Facebook and search for History Unplugged. There, you can talk with other fans of the show about recent episodes, what you liked, what you didn't like. Also, I have exclusive content there, such as live streams, where I do live versions of podcast episodes where you can leave feedback as I'm talking, and I will address it on air. Last, and I think this is the best, is to join our membership program, the Knowlton's Rangers. The Knowlton's Rangers were George Washington's spies during the Revolutionary War, but it's also the name of the membership program for History Unplugged. If you go to patreon.com/unplugged, you can join the membership program at three levels. If you join at the Scout level, you'll get all 400 episodes of History Unplugged absolutely ad-free and early access to new episodes. If you join at the second level, the Intelligence Officer level, get all the stuff that Scouts get, along with bonus episodes. There's currently about 40 of them, including series on Audie Murphy and Operation Long Jump about the Nazi attempt to assassinate FDR, Churchill, and Stalin in 1943. Finally, if you join at the Spymaster level, you'll get a shout-out to you and or your business at the end of each episode. You get a 3-pack of hardcover history books, and you can find out what those are if you go to patreon.com/unplugged. Finally, you can ask me a question about history on absolutely any topic on earth, and I will research it and devote an entire episode to your question. Probably about 30% of the questions in the archive for the show have been based on these sorts of questions. So there you go. Go to patreon.com/unplugged to learn more. All right, well, that is all for today's episode. Thank you so much for listening, and I'll see you next time.